Falls, Omine. Mardi Gras, Fat Tuesday is coming up. Got beads. In Berkeley, the Derby Creek area, the Church of the Great Green Frog is incorporated into the festivities. Frogs. This show is sponsored by Mike Kahn of Frog Stone Media, creating beautiful websites that make you money. Frogstonemedia.com. The actor Nick Offerman's father sent in this great newspaper clipping. Different drug problem. The other day, someone at a store in our town read that a methamphetamine lab had been found in an old farmhouse in the adjoining county, and he asked me a rhetorical question. Why didn't we have a drug problem when you and I were growing up? I replied, I had a drug problem when I was young. I was drugged to church on Sunday morning. I was drugged to church for weddings and funerals. I was drugged to family reunions and community socials, no matter the weather. I was drugged by my ears when I was disrespectful to adults. I was also drugged to the woodshed when I disobeyed my parents, told a lie, brought home a bad report card, did not speak with respect, spoke ill of the teacher or the preacher, or if I didn't put forth my best effort in everything that was asked of me. I was drugged to the kitchen sink to have my mouth washed out with soap if I uttered a profanity. I was drugged out to pull weeds in mom's garden and flower beds and cuckleburs out of dad's fields. I was drugged to the homes of family, friends, and neighbors to help out some poor soul who had no one to mow the yard, repair the clothesline, or chop some firewood. And if my mother had ever known that I took a single dime as a tip for this kindness, she would have drugged me back to the woodshed. Those drugs are still in my veins, and they affect my behavior in everything I do, say, or think. They are stronger than cocaine, crack, or heroin. And if today's children have this kind of drug problem, America would be a better place. God bless the parents who drugged us. I was fortunate to have parents who loved music, so I was exposed to a variety of genres. Classic, country and western, Broadway musicals, and a little rock. I say fortunate because music profoundly affects our entire brain. Diverse types of music stimulate and soothe, unsettle and heal. What a lucky girl I was to be raised in such a healthy environment. When I first became aware of the music healing modality, I thought, of course. But what's obvious to me isn't necessarily obvious to others. So I spoke with Tara McConnell of McConnell Music Therapy Services about all things music therapy. So what are the variety of instruments that you personally utilize in your music therapy endeavors?
I use a variety of instruments, mostly the guitar, piano. The voice is the most accessible instrument we all have, close to our heart. That is very, very therapeutic for people. People that don't necessarily have any singing experience, learning to vocalize can be very powerful for them. I use drumming. I've used a variety of string instruments. I'm a double bass player. That's my degree.
Oh,
and
nice.
So I have used a double bass occasionally. It's a little hard to lug around. But it's amazing the vibrations that come from that instrument. Working.
Well, that's what I was thinking. You know, music, of course, relieves stress, but I was thinking physical healing attributes. The tones resonate not only with your heartbeat, of
right.
course, the flow of oxygen and blood throughout your body, and
Absolutely.
Even the syntaxes of your brain.
Mm-hmm. When you're engaged in music, active music making, and this is not, doesn't have to be professional quality, it's getting a mallet, playing a drum, and keeping a beat with somebody else. Very accessible. Your full brain is being used, all the parts of your brain simultaneously. So you're affecting emotions, you're affecting communication, even if it's nonverbal communication. You're affecting your cognition, the memories that are induced by a certain song or a certain lyric are fully engaged. You're using your motor coordination and balance. So everything gets integrated together.
Now, let's hear a little bit about your background. Did music in your house when you were growing up?
Yes. I started taking piano lessons when I was 8. Parents were not musical, but both my grandmothers were.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yes. And we grew up in our house listening to Kenny Rogers and all kinds of country music, Ann Murray and all those people. And really, I didn't have a whole lot of exposure to a variety of styles. It was through learning music and then wanting to play piano in the jazz band in junior high that kind of broadened all of my relationship with music. They didn't want they wanted, but there were way too many people trying out for piano at the junior high jazz band. So my teacher, wonderful teacher, Mr. Ed LaFranchi, Barrett Junior High, and said, here, have this electric bass and learn it over the summer and you can be the bass player. And that's from then on, I started branching out and started going to symphonies, and it changed my life.
Well, tell me about your grandmothers.
My grandmother eventually, my mom's mom eventually lived with us, and she would sit and play the piano, and we'd sit and play duets. I learned all the classic songs, and she has all the sheet music of the 20s and 30s and 40s
cool.
with all the beautiful artwork. And I was just fascinated by the artwork of this sheet music and wanted to play it. And we would sit and play duets. And she lived with us until she passed away. Very precious memory. My other grandmother, Nina Sachs, she lived in Stockton and went to school. She did postgraduate work at University of the Pacific in cello performance back in the 40s. And when I went to college at UOP, she lived there and she actually played in the symphony with me when I was in college.
Nice.
And so we shared that. We're also both charter members of Sigma Alpha Iota, which is a music fraternity for women.
Nice. Multi-generational.
Yes. So
Delta Girls.
Yes. And so she was just impeccable musician and just always challenged me to be the best.
That helps, I think, in all walks of life if you have that one person who cares enough.
Right.
To give you that little kick in the backside.
Yeah. And it was both my grandmothers that helped me purchase my first double bass, which is, you know, when you're in college, a pretty big purchase.
What was your first public performance? What did you play?
Oh, piano. I have many music teachers, but Dorothy Carpenter was my piano teacher from Carmichael. She taught us with the Robert Pace method, and it was twice a week with pairs and groups doing group lessons. And once a month, we'd have these group performances for our parents. And so from a very early age, I mean, I consider that my first memory of stepping up and playing for people. And then it became so routine, there was never any nerves after that. There just weren't. And she never, ever gave up on me. I remember being so overwhelmed. I think I was 10 and just trying to keep up with homework and dance and all these things. And I was just really struggling and wanted to quit. And she told my mom, do not quit. Do not let her quit. She has a gift. And at that point, I could have really quit and it would have changed the direction of my life. But my mom, too, stuck with it. She's an incredible person.
Good
too.
For mom.
She's a mom. She knew. And then that transitioned into playing in high school. Paul Werschmidt was one of my other amazing teachers, and I'm still in contact with him. And
oh, that's nice.
Yeah, he challenged me at every level, and I played percussion in the wind ensemble and bass in the jazz band because I didn't play a wind instrument or woodwind, but I needed to be in the band to play in the jazz band. So encouraged me to audition for UOP. The path that led me to music school and getting there is just a total miracle at this point. They needed basses when I needed a big challenge and a big kick in the butt. And worked. And I had an awesome teacher there too, Thomas Sturthick. And he was the principal bassist for the Sacramento Symphony. Yeah, it was hard.
It's like a musical military, you know, when they say, okay, you know, 50 push-ups. And you say, thank you, sir.
Yeah, that's what it is. And, you know, I learned a lot. I learned that as a bassist, I'm not necessarily drawn to playing classical music. But what I learned through that process has helped me with discipline like nobody's business.
There are a lot of successful musicians who said they started out in classical.
You know, and I started really in jazz and then went to classical. And then I still love my electric bass. And then after college, I was in a local band in Sacramento and we played all over.
What was your name of your band?
St. Simon 3.
Okay.
And that was a lot of fun. And it was finally the time where I felt like I was coming into my own as a musician. And I love performing.
What were some of the pieces that you played?
It was all original.
Really?
All original music. And we played in clubs, Fox and Goose and Old Ironsides and all around town.
Fun.
Yeah. Definitely. And I played my upright bass, but it was more rockabilly meets
fun.
Buddy Holly.
Yeah.
With like Dylan-esque lyrics. I mean, just just really, really a lot of fun.
Creative.
Yes, very creative.
So you've really covered the genre as far as the different sections of the orchestra for the most part, except for brass, I guess.
Yeah, I did do percussion in the brass ensemble in college. Yeah. I've been in probably almost every kind of different ensemble.
Did you do
ensemble.
The bell? Did you play the triangle?
Oh, yes, and the xylophone and all that. Yeah, it was great because my piano background, I could play the mallet instruments because they're set up like a piano. And, of course, there's lots of training too, but it's the black notes and the white notes, like xylophone, marimba.
Right. So I'm thinking as a music therapist for physical healing, you know what it physically feels like to absorb those tones.
Yes. And actually, how I ended up as a music therapist is really checking a box at University of the Pacific, which is another miracle thing, where I wanted to go there, but I knew that I had a chance at getting a scholarship if I was a conservatory major.
Okay.
And I thought music therapy. Oh, I did some kind of little report in high school on music therapy, and I knew a friend at the time who was down at Cal State Northridge in music therapy, and so I thought, okay, that sounds interesting. So I showed up my first day of college, and my professor, Audrey O'Connell, totally, she had us on the floor, feeling music vibration, would play the piano and sing, and we were learning how the brain receives music, how you use music for relaxation, how you guide somebody through an experience in music to really heal their body. It was the first day of college. I was blown away and in love, and I knew that's what I had to do. There's never really been a question of what I needed to do. It's more of, okay, how do I do it? And private practice now has been perfect for me because as soon as I get a crazy idea, I can just go with it and try to meet as many people as we can.
How many different facilities, type of facilities, hospitals, I would imagine, rehab care facilities? Or
we currently work with Sutter Health, Sutter Medical Foundation down in Sacramento, providing inpatient care to the Sutter Cancer Center for people in the hospital. We also, just this year, were able to restart the pediatric program at Sutter Memorial. In 2009, we started doing group therapy at Sutter Center for Psychiatry, so inpatient psychiatric hospital, kids as young as 5 through adults. And in all of those venues, you really see the immediate power of what you do by bringing not only a different environment, but different form of therapy to these people to help them. Also, see private clients in their home, people with Parkinson's, people with Down syndrome. We work with school districts as part of IEP programs for students with disabilities. See, one of my most current projects is working with a group called Courage Worldwide, and it's a program here in Placer County that was developed to rescue and house girls that have been rescued from sex trafficking. Every summer we do a songwriting camp with them, and for a year we were able to do music therapy on a volunteer basis. We're currently waiting for funding to really develop a creative arts therapy program, but that is another venue. In all of these situations, the typical verbal therapy
doesn't cut it.
It doesn't work, and it doesn't create the therapeutic outcomes. And that's a fancy word of saying there are no words. When there are no words, music helps you express.
Pain can have a great depth,
right,
to it, and music doesn't judge. Music, you can often have a pleasant memory association with it,
right,
in addition to painful. Music is a natural spelunking tool. I guess is how I would put it.
That's a great analogy.
That's why I am so behind music therapy. I just think it's absolutely phenomenal. I used to babysit my cousin's little ones, and I was taking them for a ride one day, and I have all the different stations on Pandora, and I have one where it's just, you know, screaming crazy people, and she just started laughing, and I said, she goes, "What are you listening to?" I said, "Well, you know, sometimes you're just having one of those days, and somebody's screaming for you." as you're driving is a great release.
That's exactly it. There's so many misperceptions, too, of what music therapy is. People think, oh, it's nice and lovely, and you dance through the forest playing harps and Birkenstocks, and you're just happy. You make everybody happy. And that is so not what it is. Music therapy is not nice. It's expressive. And there have been more times than not that I have used harder, louder, angrier music, the better. Because the whole... And that's really sets music therapy apart from like music wellness and different kinds of avenues, because therapists use that tool specifically to get an outcome that is related to their a patient's therapeutic goals. If you have a teenager that is not talking and they are angry and they are hospitalized and you don't know what else to do and you play something like that, you immediately have them, because your job as a therapist is not to immediately make change. Your job is to meet people where they are and then slowly help bring them out.
Yeah, I was thinking about that. With each person that you work with, you'd almost have to start from scratch because people are truly unique.
Right, and that's where music therapy assessment.
Yes.
I mean, it's just like any other therapy where there's an assessment phase and rapport building, and then there's intervention where strategic music is used and planned, whether that's improvisational or separate songs or writing music, writing lyrics. You know, the therapist designs a program and then it's evaluated in a sense of, is it meeting the outcomes? And if not, then you go back and you reframe the goals. I love it because it's that science part of me that I love something that's very organized in process, but yet gives me the creativity in the implementation to meet that person. I mean, we do painting to music, sometimes with private clients, even in the hospital, using music experience to meet their goals.
Structured and freewheeling at the same time.
Absolutely.
1 foot on either side of the continental divide. That's how I live my life as well.
So. Yeah, and the spelunking part, music has that. Music can take you to a place, and anyone on this planet absolutely can relate to this, where you hear that one line or that even one, two bars of a song, and it will take you to a time, a place, a feeling, an experience, and a memory instantly. Now, the same process is used with healing, where especially people with dementia, you instantly get to a place of recall, a place that they can remember, and that the same process is used maybe with somebody who's been abused. It's the disconnect, and music can connect those dots. Now, that's why another thing is to really, if you have a very, well, anyone really, if you're working on therapeutic goals, is to work with somebody who's trained and board certified in music therapy, because you can do damage if you don't know what you're doing. Because of that way, it can profoundly affect your brain and the damaged portions of your brain, whether it be due to a stroke or some kind of brain injury or emotional pain that has caused brain changes.
Yes, everybody wants to be an armchair therapist.
And yes, and music is so accessible. It is so accessible that it can be dangerous. It is so powerful, and it, because it touches every part of our brain and we feel it with every cell in our body, you got to make sure you know what you're doing. There's a time and a place for certain types of music, and with more vulnerable populations, it's even more so.
Music therapy should not be treated lightly.
Right, and that's why there's board certification, and that's why we're hired by lots of different types of agencies, because of that quality assurance.
Professional agencies.
Yes, professional agencies, yes. Absolutely. That's not to say we don't own music, or that we own it, or that, you know, you have to be a music therapist. Absolutely, more music in people's lives, the better. But pay attention to how it affects you.
I know in metaphysics, Pythagoras had his music of the spheres, and a lot of metaphysicians take that same concept.
It's essentially the beginning of music therapy.
Well, yeah, that each person has their own individual key note.
Right.
So if you play that note, whether it's on a tuner or on a piano, what have you, it brings you back to center. Have you found that to be true?
Yes, and a lot of that is based on Eastern medicine too, with chakras and the different frequencies that our bodies carry in different parts of our bodies. Frequency, we all are frequency. We are all vibrational beings. And finding what matches a person is our goal.
Right. The thing about chakras, while we do have energy points, medians, one size does not fill all.
Right.
Which some Eastern practices try to push.
Right, right.
So I like that idea of the unique keynote.
Mm-hmm.
And also playing bowls, Tibetan bowls, glass versus yes. the higher notes, the lower, the depths, whatever. Actually, that also transcends over to colors.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Darker versus lighter.
Absolutely. And there's been lots of research with color therapy.
And I was thinking combining the two yes. would just be holy moly.
Yes, there are some, have a colleague that is a chiropractic neurologist. And he is studying this exact concept. And we've collaborated and have some things in the works. But I don't want to let the cat out of the bag quite yet.
Stay tuned.
Yes. Dun, dun, dun.
I just turned on the radio a few days ago and I kind of laughed because it was hardly a newsflash to me. But that if you sing for 5-10 minutes a day, your blood pressure goes down.
Yes. Those
heart
endorphins go up. Yes.
Just singing to the car radio. Yes. Or...
Well, and people have such a self-concept around singing. It's so interesting because it's not something, I think, as a society, I think we've lost a little bit of that comfort.
Well, American Idol doesn't help because they're being judged. So it just reinforces the judgment.
Yes. And actually, what I always like to remind people, we didn't have this separation of performers on the stage and the audience until really opera and piano were invented. And there became the musicians, and only the musicians would play for the high courts. And just a few hundred years ago, really, as a culture, as a humanity, most of our history is making music at some level, back to prehistoric times. People use drums to communicate. There's lots of different theories out there, but there's community music making in the streets, in people's homes, naturally, until this separation came with the stage and the orchestra or the singers and the quote-unquote audience. And I think, you know, that's totally evolved into this American Idol mentality that people are so self-conscious anyway. And then you add this judgment, and then you take away really the piano in everyone's home, 1950s.
That everybody would stand around.
Everybody. And I heard stories from my grandmother, and it's proof with the pile of sheet music that I still have from her that occurred. And people together would make music together. And it's part of our humanity. And I think then the evolution of the iPod and the most access to music we've ever had in our history at our fingertips. And yet it's isolative. People they're plugged into their headphones. And so there's this, what I try to talk about and share is this is art. There's no right or wrong. You know, in a group therapy situation at the hospital, there'll maybe 15 people and I'll give them each an instrument. And through that process, they learn to listen to each other. They learn to experience what it's like to lead. And this is all facilitated, of mm-hmm. course, at first. And what it's like to follow and what it's like to really just express yourself without judgment. That is huge. That is, I can't tell you how huge that is in that type of setting. And then even just in our communities, you don't need to be, you know, in the psychiatric hospital to experience this. In the communities, I always encourage people, find your local drum circle, your local music store.
Well, karaoke.
Yes.
Almost every place has it one night a week, at least one night a week. And you attend any of those, and it's pretty clear that not everyone has a natural singing voice. But it doesn't matter because they're just having fun.
Right.
And everybody, well, most of the audience is there for you. They can see that you don't sing that well, but you're having fun. And so they're having fun with you having fun.
Exactly.
It's a great release.
And so, you know, that's why people gather in churches and sing together and worship. That's why music is a part of worship. That's why communities are drawn together. That's why people go to big rock concerts and they sing all the songs because they know all the songs together. We're trying. We're not going to let it escape us as a culture, but I think we need to be reminded of why we do it and how healthy it is.
I saw Eddie Vedder on an interview or show, I should say, on Sundance on their Iconoclasts show. And he says he looks out before a concert and every member in that audience are coming from different perspectives, experiences, different viewpoints. Mm-hmm. He said, but for the next 2 hours, they will all agree on something.
Yes.
It unifies.
And there's power in that.
And unification is healing.
Absolutely. And I think that's why music therapy groups are so powerful. And a lot of times we'll create songs. This my favorite part of songwriting. Just having people come up with one word, even, that describes how they cope, for instance. And you write them and you create a song around it. Just an improvisational song. And I, you know, tell people, we're not shooting for a top 40 hit. But giving a voice to that one word, or in that moment, giving it melody, helps the brain receive it in a different way. Music creates new neuropathways that are different to access information.
Do you have any suggestions for someone out there who has a loved one who's suffering from dementia or Alzheimer's that maybe doesn't have access to a music therapy program?
Find music they like. Have them listen to it, sing it to them, and you will be surprised. I've seen it happen where people literally will get a glimpse of their loved one again. It is very powerful. I worked in a nursing home many years ago, and there was a man with dementia, and his wife would come every week. He was in a wheelchair, wasn't walking, wasn't responding really, unless I was there with my guitar singing his songs. She happened to be there, and he stood up and they danced. And so when I talk about the whole brain, not only was his cognition a little more clear, he was able to balance. His motor coordination was able to support him standing. That was huge for them to have that, even those 5 minutes of time together. You know, you see it happen, you know, with people with Parkinson's who aren't walking steady. And are shuffling their feet. You give them the accurate rhythm in a piece of music that's familiar to them with a metronome sound behind it, or even just the metronome sometimes with singing, and their steps will become more evenly paced. Neurologic music therapy it's an expanded, more precise version of music therapy specifically for neurological impairment.
That's awesome.
Yeah, one of the music therapists on staff at the time, she now lives in Texas and we miss her, but she had a person with Parkinson's on her caseload, and they used very strategic scientific models of measuring gait through videotape, taking data on stride length, and accurately then finding the best beat per minute to be used. This is very scientific based.
Yes.
And providing a program that they could do every day.
Lovely.
And it's, again, with things like Parkinson's or in terminal cancer, your goal is not to cure. But with this one particular woman, her goal, she lived in Truckee, and her goal was to go on a walk around her neighborhood. So by golly, she got there and she did that walk. And that's why we do what we do, because life is too precious to not use something like music that's so accessible.
The highest quality you can help them live is
absolutely
winning the lottery.
Right. And in one situation, it could be giving people enough motivation to help themselves and give them hope and to realize their life has value. They don't need to take their own life. They are worthy. They have purpose and they have value and they're precious. It can go from that to a little girl with Down syndrome who's learning to make the S sound, you know, and creating a program for her with songs and recordings specifically for that S sound that she can practice with. It's just so diverse.
I would imagine that autism is probably the easiest with music because they are so aware of sound.
Yes, and in some, but again, it's individual. There's a huge spectrum of autism. Every child has different sensory needs, so sometimes auditory input can be too much, depending on the child.
Okay.
However, music is a perfect way to help desensitize some of those highly hypersensitive senses. There's a little girl with autism that I worked with right when I first started practicing. She did not like sound. Sound was very hard for her brain to process. And slowly, very patiently, we helped her. And it's really, really, this is a really special story to me because I still have a relationship with this young woman. She's now going to be 22 years old this month. Mm. And she was 4 years old when we started. And she is a vocalist. She has done musical theater way back in her early elementary years. You know, the sensitivities to sound became sensitivities to tactile, kinesthetic types of things. So she wanted to sing. She now loved to sing, but was very sensitive to the microphones that they would tape to her face.
Oh, okay.
Soon, that was worked on, and she shines. She's amazing. She is now in college, and she's an amazing mathematician as well, and just inspiration to anyone. As this whole group of people with autism are now adults, that's a whole other podcast on why, but a lot of these young kids 20 years ago are now adults, and as a society, there's many, many people with autism. This is just a shout out to the people that work with anybody, whether you're the parent or the therapist or community member that's supporting somebody with autism. They are people and they're amazing. Just be there.
Well, I love what you're doing. So rock on.
Yay!
After silence, that which comes nearest to expressing the inexpressible is music. Aldous Huxley. In my ongoing tribute to the 150th anniversary of the National Park System, I'm heading over to Maine this week to the first Eastern National Park. Originally designated as a national monument in 1916 as Sieur de Monts, it was redesignated as Lafayette National Park in 1919, and then once again redesignated as Acadia National Park in 1929. Encompassing more than 47,000 acres, Acadia includes Mount Desert Island and Cadillac Mountain, the tallest mountain on the U.S. Atlantic coast. During certain times of the year, it's the first place in the country to see the sunrise. The Rockefellers, Morgans, Fords, Vanderbilts, Carnegies, and Astors spent their summers at Mount Desert Island. In fact, due to the efforts of John D. Rockefeller Jr., a skilled horseman, 45 miles of rustic carriage roads run through the park. A devastating fire in October 1947 burned thousands of acres. It was so intense. After rain and snow, weeks later, fire still smoldered below ground. At one point, all roads from the town of Bar Harbor were blocked by flames, so nearby fishermen assisted with a mass exodus of at least 400 people fleeing by boat. When bulldozers were able to plow through rubble on Route 3, a caravan of 700 cars began their exodus. According to eyewitness reports, cars were pelted by sparks and flames flickered overhead. Scary. Speaking of scary, the Precipice Trail on Champlain Mountain. It's listed as a non-technical climbing route, ascending cliffs 800 feet high with sections of iron rungs to assist climbers. Now, this is where it gets a little dicey for me. In many places, the trail is less than 18 inches wide, with drop-offs of up to 200 feet. I've developed an acute depth perception the last few years, so I'd have to pass. Acadia National Park is considered one of the premier birdwatching areas in the country, with the record of 338 bird species encountered. I would love to go on the hawk watch. Thousands of raptors from Maine and Canada migrate south along the eastern coastline. Because Cadillac Mountain offers expansive views and the tallest vantage point, visitors get a close look at the soaring raptors. How cool is that? If you're looking to spend some quality environmental time in Maine, an upcoming volunteer vacation is available at the Moosehorn National Wildlife Refuge. Visit AmericanHiking.org. March 2nd is Theodore Geisel's birthday, or, as we lovingly know him, Dr. Seuss. My uncle ordered popovers from the restaurant's bill of fare, and when they were served, he regarded them with a penetrating stare. Then he spoke great words of wisdom as he sat there on that chair. "To eat these things," said my uncle, "you must exercise great care. You may swallow down what's solid, but you must spit out the air." And as you partake of the world's bill of fare, that's darn good advice to follow. do a lot of spitting out the hot air, and be careful what you swallow. My uncle Terwilliger. Dr. Seuss, of course, brought fun into the process of learning to read, so the National Education Association's 17th annual Read Across America follows on March 3rd. If you have children, it is imperative that you read to them when they are very young. It stimulates their language development, imagining everything they hear, enhances their vocabularies, and use longer sentences, increases their attention spans, and focus on what is being said. And they become more curious, which leads to accumulating more knowledge throughout their life. I know parents are busy. You can still set aside 15 minutes each day to read to your child. For those who are not parents, check with your local library, school, and park and recreation district, and volunteer as a reader. You'll have a blast. I promise. Do something different. Tie your other shoe first.